This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Sarah Van Gelder, co-founder and editor-at-large at Yes Magazine. Sarah Van Gelder is here today to tell us about her Edge of Change road trip, which she began last August. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you so much for having me.
What is the purpose of your Edge of Change road trip?
Well, we started Yes about 20 years ago, and we've been writing stories about people all over the United States who are doing extraordinary things. But for myself, I've mostly been in the office assigning those stories to other people, and I decided it was time for me to get out of the office and see some of this for myself. So part of it was just to say, you know, are these stories really the best ones? Are we really honing in on where there are the best opportunities for the kind of deep change that we think we need to have at this point in human history? And the other part of it was to see what else we're missing, to go to the places that don't usually get covered and go there myself and talk to people and say, you know what, what's inspiring you and what stories do we need that we don't already know about? So it's actually been a wonderful trip so far. I'm about halfway through.
How long do you plan to be on the road and what places will you visit?
I plan to continue through to just before Christmas. I'll get home in time to have Christmas with my family. So as you said, I've been traveling since mid-August. I spent quite a bit of time in Montana and then North Dakota, Wisconsin, Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, Cincinnati, and right now I'm at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana doing a residency for a week. And from here, I'm planning to head to the southeast, to the Appalachian part of the country, to the south, and then somewhat to the northeast, although so often when I'm traveling, I fly to the east coast and see what's going on there. And so I'm trying to, especially, like I said, get to the places I don't normally get to. And then I'll come back via the southwest and try to learn about what's happening in the border regions.
Would you say more about how you decided which places and or people to visit? What are your criteria?
Right, so I'm interested in the places that I don't normally get to. So the places that I can get to, I have a little tiny pickup truck and camper on the back of the pickup truck. So that lets me get to places that are much more remote, like Native American reservations that are, you know, in southeast Montana, where they want to build a gigantic strip mine for mining coal. So it gives me a chance to get to places that I wouldn't ordinarily get to. So that's one criteria, is the places at the edge that aren't getting covered either by us or by other people. Another one is, where does it seem like there's real possibilities for deep change? So, for example, in that area of southeast Montana where they want to put in the coal mine, what are people saying about that? How are they resisting the power of these giant corporations that want to extract yet more fossil fuels at a time when our atmosphere just absolutely cannot afford to have more fossil fuels dumped into it? And what are they trying to build instead? The ranchers and the native people on this reservation, what kind of a state, what kind of a world do they envision, and what would they like to pass along to their children and grandchildren? So it's a place that's sort of on the edge, because I think a lot of time change doesn't come from the centers of power. The centers of power are too entrenched in the status quo. You know, they're led by people who are benefiting from the status quo and don't necessarily want to see a lot of deep change, although oftentimes they're looking for changes at the edges of the status quo. But I'm really interested in the people that are more interested and more willing to step up to really deep systemic change.
Would you just underscore the questions that you hope to answer as a result of your trip?
Sure. So the questions are based on my reading of the times we're in, which is that we're in a time when we're up against the climate crisis. We're starting to actually see the effects of climate change in some fairly dire ways, with the drought in California, the excessive heat and ocean acidification in the Northwest, the large storms that are hitting many parts of the country, including South Carolina. So we're starting to feel the effects of climate change, but as the scientists have been telling us, climate change is not a linear phenomenon. In other words, we can't just say, oh, oops, at a certain point, maybe we'll turn down the heat because that was too much. Part of the crisis is that we can pass certain thresholds, and then we can be completely unable to turn down the heat again. So given that we absolutely cannot afford to continue to put so much fossil fuel into the atmosphere, one of my big questions is, who is solving that problem? Who is really taking on both the extraction of additional fossil fuel and all the new infrastructure that is proposed for getting coal and oil and natural gas to the coast so it can be exported to Asia? Who is taking on resisting that? And how effective are they at doing that? And then on the other hand, how are we rebuilding our society so that it can be more sustainable, so that we can operate with less fossil fuel, so that we can operate in a way that's more just, so that everyone can have a part of the kind of a society that we're starting to build? So for that, I've been especially going to some of the old Rust Belt cities where the economy that had sustained them, that had provided living wage jobs, that economy is gone essentially for those cities. And I'm looking at the creative grassroots efforts now underway to build a different kind of an economy, you know, a cooperative economy, an economy that's based in a local, the resources of that local area. Many of them are based in a local food economy and getting people healthier through connecting with their local bioregions. So those are the kinds of questions, is what works for people in the planet? What are people creating in their communities that can help us to create the kind of life that will make us healthy, our environment healthy, and create a society that we can sustain into the future?
You mentioned you were traveling in a pickup truck with a camper, and your camper has a snail painted on it. What's the symbolism of the snail?
So the symbolism is, I have some friends on the Suquamish Reservation where I live, and I asked them if they would be willing to paint it for me, and I thought they would do a small emblem, you know, on the front or something of that sort. But they said, no, we'll paint the whole thing. So the camper actually is painted to look like a snail. You can see photographs of it on my blog at edgeofchange.yesmagazine.org. And the symbolism is several things. One is, of course, the snail carries its home around with it, which is what I'm doing, living in my little camper. And a second one is that snails move kind of slowly, which is also true of my road trip because I'm taking 5 months to do this travel. So I like the idea of moving slowly. I like the idea of slow journalism, just like slow food, which is, you know, instead of fast food where you rush in and scarf down some food and it's not very healthy. The idea here is to take my time in different parts of our amazing country and get to know people and get to know what's really working for them. And so understand at a somewhat deeper level the kinds of changes that are happening, again, in some of the communities that don't normally get covered by national media. And then there's also the symbolism of the caracol, which is a Spanish word that means snail shell. But also in the Mayan culture, it has to do with the word, because they use a shell for calling people over distances. So it's a form of self-expression. And in the Zapatista territory, it's also a place of autonomous self-governance. So it's kind of like this little liberated space on the back of my truck as I travel around the country, where it's its own little autonomous zone.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Sarah Van Gelder, co-founder and editor-at-large at Yes Magazine. Our topic is Sarah's Edge of Change road trip. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Well, you've alluded a bit to this already, but what have you experienced and learned from your visit to Montana and North Dakota?
Yeah, so those were the regions I was especially looking at, the question of how people are resisting the extraction of fossil fuel. So, yeah, as I mentioned, there's this giant mine proposed for the Otter Creek region of southeast Montana. And what I found is a really serious resistance coming from a collaborative process involving both the Northern Cheyenne people and the non-native ranchers who ranch around in that same area. And I was so interested to see, when I saw them actually together, to see how much they had in common in terms of how they talked about the land and talked about their responsibility to the land. Both the ranchers and the native people who were speaking talked about the sacredness of the land and the sacredness of water, they have this beautiful valley. I hadn't actually expected to find it to be such a beautiful place, but it's this lovely valley, very quiet and remote, between two small mountain ranges, some of it sort of dry plain, some of it wooded. And the ranchers have been there for generations. Their families have been ranching for generations. These are smaller ranches, not big corporate ranches. And the ranchers talked about, you know, wanting to be able to pass along those beautiful areas to their children and their grandchildren, and that they have that sacred responsibility to do that. And that was the same language that, of course, the Native people were using, who have also been in that region for generations and also want to be able to pass along clean water and pristine landscapes to their children and to future generations. So that was one thing I learned, was about that and about the resistance to the coal mine railroad spur that would have to be built to get the coal to the main railroad line so it could be transported probably to Bellingham. At least that's the plan, is to put that big coal terminal in Bellingham at the Cherry Point land. And the Lummi tribe, of course, is adamantly opposed to that happening. And the Lummi tribe, actually, while I was there, I attended a ceremony where the Lummi tribe brought a totem pole that they had carved as a gift to the Northern Cheyenne people. And so they were reflecting on the ways in which this one particular project that would put billions of tons of carbon dioxide into our atmosphere, how these two tribes at either end of this project are both opposed, and both would be devastated by the damage that would be done to their local area. And of course, all of us would be damaged by having that much more carbon put into the atmosphere. So that was the story I was tracking in Montana. In North Dakota, I visited two tribes. One is at the Fort Berthold Reservation, and this is a place where there's been an enormous amount of fracking for natural gas and oil. And when you enter that part of the state, you find a sort of a hazy smog from all the oil wells and all the flares that are flaring off natural gas into the atmosphere. So this enormous kind of boom of new people moving in to work in those oil fields and these brand new sort of temporary makeshift developments, and the community kind of overrun by people coming in to work in the oil fields. So they've had these enormous problems. They've had problems with corruption because so much money is flowing through, and with prostitution and with human trafficking. And some families in the tribe have a lot of money and others don't, depending on which families have gas wells or oil wells on their land. So this was kind of a sad community. And then I visited another reservation called the Turtle Mountain Reservation, which is north central North Dakota. And there the folks, especially the women, looked at what was happening and said, you know, we don't actually want that happening here. This is a place that has just beautiful, pristine water and these lovely lakes and forests and prairie land. And it's an absolutely beautiful part of North Dakota. And they realized that if they were to allow fracking to go through, they could be putting all of that at risk. All of those aquifers and those lakes could be at risk. So they passed a resolution, the tribal council passed a resolution banning fracking on their reservation, and then found out that the Bureau of Indian Affairs had been on the brink of allowing leases of oil and gas wells, and all those leases were canceled. So that place was a delight to visit because it had that sense that, you know, that maybe they don't have as much money, but they have this sense of control over their lives and a sense that they can pass something along to their children and grandchildren that will be in as good a shape as they inherited it.
In the blog you're doing about the trip, you say that everywhere you go, people take you to water. Would you explain?
Yeah, it was so interesting to me because I didn't initially go out to research water per se. But what happened when I got to Montana is that especially Elena Buffalo Spirit from the Northern Cheyenne tribe, one of the first places she wanted to show me was the Tongue River, which is this beautiful, simple river. It's not a spectacular river with lots of white water. It's just a very simple river that runs through that part right along the border of the reservation. But it's good, clean water, and it's abundant, and they can count on it. And it is important in a place that can sometimes be an arid part of the world that you have that clean, abundant water to rely on. And if the coal mine goes through, of course, that's at risk along with the railroad spur, which would go right along the edge of the Tongue River. So a lot of times, of course, you put transportation corridors in along rivers because they tend to track the most level way of getting from point A to point B. So the Tongue River would be the route of choice, at least for part of that railroad spur. So people want to protect that, you know. They look at that river and they say, you know, this is sacred. This water is sacred. And likewise, when I went up to the Fort Berthold Reservation, there was an enormous lake there, and Prairie Rose Seminole, who I interviewed there from that tribe, explained to me that that lake is actually created artificially via a dam, and that the villages where the native people used to live were drowned by that giant lake, and people had to move, and one of the places they moved is to a town that's now called Newtown. Evidently, someone put up a sign that just said Newtown, thinking someone would eventually name it, but no one gave it a different name, so that's what it's now called, is Newtown, North Dakota. And so you can sort of see the difference in a place where the water is not in its wild state. It's been dammed, and it has that different artificial feel to it. And then in Turtle Mountain Reservation, there, again, these beautiful lakes that are the surface manifestation of an underground aquifer that evidently is just huge. And again, a pristine and very precious source for the people living in that region and for the farmers who surround the reservation. The farmers, what I was told by the chief of the Turtle Mountain tribe, the farmers were actually very grateful that the tribe prohibited fracking because it means that the aquifer that they rely on as well is safeguarded. So it just keeps coming back to this notion that water is really central. In Detroit, water has a whole other way it's showing up politically, which is that despite being at the edge of one of the most abundant sources of fresh water in the world, which is the Great Lakes, Detroit is in the midst of an enormous wave of water shutoffs. People are getting bills that they can't comprehend because, you know, in many cases they've been paying their water bills, but suddenly they'll get a bill for $1,000 or $10,000, and when they don't pay and they can't get anyone to straighten it out with them, a company has been hired to go along and shut off all the people not paying their bills. And, of course, a lot of these people are quite poor. It's an amazingly impoverished city, and people are actually struggling to get by without water. They're running hoses from their neighbors. Churches are setting up watering stations where people can go fill up with drinking water. And it gets worse because if social services finds out that there's a child living in a house where the water's been shut off, they're actually looking at taking the children away from their parents. So it's just devastating for people to be in this situation where water is becoming such a scarcity for no apparent reason, because there is so much water, fresh water to be had there. They actually brought in the United Nations Human Rights Rapporteur to look at this situation. I was at their hearing about a year ago when they were investigating because of the human rights violation of preventing people from having this basic human need.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Sarah Van Gelder, co-founder and editor-at-large at Yes Magazine. Our topic is Sarah's Edge of Change road trip. What have you experienced and learned so far from your visit to the Rust Belt?
Well, what I've been finding is that there is a new economy. It's still nascent. You know, it's still not big enough to employ anywhere near the number of people who are desperate for regular and family wage jobs. But it is a model that people are getting very excited about, which is the model of cooperatives. So I've seen those in the works in Cleveland and Cincinnati and to a lesser degree in Detroit, but Cleveland and Cincinnati especially. In Cleveland, there's the Evergreen Cooperatives, which we've written about in Yes Magazine over the years as they've developed. And there the model is so many of the cities are very divided between relatively affluent, thriving institutions like universities and hospitals and incredibly impoverished neighborhoods, which are often right next to these very affluent institutions. So in Cleveland, they decided to use the buying power of the universities and the hospitals to find ways of creating long-term family wage jobs. So, for example, they started a cooperative that provides laundry services to the hospital. The hospital will always need laundry services, and why not provide those jobs right in the neighborhood adjacent to the hospital to help alleviate the poverty that's right there? So I visited that laundry and spoke to a guy named Chris Brown, and I'm going to post the video I have of him on my blog as soon as I can get to it. But it was so inspiring to hear how he framed it. You know, he said, I never thought I would own a part of anything. He'd kind of been bounced around from job to job. It sounded like he spent a little bit of time in prison. And this was the first time, he's been there for 3 years now and is now a supervisor in this co-op, the first time that he felt like he had a piece of the American dream. He could co-own this company with other worker owners like himself from the neighborhood. And they have a project that's associated with it, which we just covered in Yes Magazine, that helps those worker owners also become homeowners so that they actually take homes that were in foreclosure and make them available to the worker owners to buy, and they can pay them off in something like 4 years, paying about the same amount as they would otherwise be paying for rent. So as a result, these people get a stake in their neighborhoods, and they're spending their paychecks into the neighborhoods. And that means that these neighborhoods also have a chance of working their way slowly out of poverty. The same sort of model I found in Cincinnati in terms of the interest in worker co-ops, but they're working on a variation which involves bringing in the labor unions. So they actually are working on developing food-oriented farm, a distribution center, a food co-op, so different food-oriented cooperatives with the food and commercial workers union very involved in making all of this happen. And that seems like it's just the beginning of making that model a reality, but it seems like it's got some enormous potential.
From the co-ops that you've seen, do there seem to be any special challenges that they're facing?
Yeah, I mean, anytime you're sort of starting from a situation where the entire community is so impoverished, there's a lot of work to do to get a new economic institution, you know, any kind of business going in that kind of a setting. There's training. A lot of the Cincinnati co-ops talked about the need for training, and also the co-op I talked to in Chicago. You know, where do you get the training? So that's one of the nice things about the union collaboration is that the unions, for at least some of the trades, have developed some really great training infrastructure. So if the co-ops can make use of that training infrastructure and the healthcare insurance and some of the other sort of back office support that unions can offer, they can get off the ground more quickly.
Do you have a favorite success story from your trip?
Oh, man. One favorite is the co-op in Chicago. I've got a post on this right now on my blog and also at yesmagazine.org. Several years ago, the Republic Window and Door Company decided to shut down. And when they did, they decided not to pay the workers their back wages. So the workers occupied the factory, and eventually, actually, even President Obama, who was recently elected at that point, spoke up, and they were paid their back wages. And instead of the factory shutting down, a new owner bought the factory and reopened. This was Sirius Energy, was called, from California. So the workers went back to work, and that was all good. But meanwhile, they were kind of aware of how precarious their jobs were and started looking into other models, including going to Argentina and learning about worker-owned cooperatives in Argentina. So when Sirius Energy announced they were going to shut down and they were going to liquidate the factory, the workers said, we'd like to talk to you about buying it. And it looked like the liquidation was going to go ahead, that they were going to just sell all the equipment and make that impossible. So the workers occupied the factory once again and were able to slow down the liquidation long enough to be able to work out a deal to buy the factory. So now they own it, and they've been running it for several years now, and I had a chance to interview a couple of the worker owners, and they just seemed so happy. You know, he said they work really hard, and they had to learn how to run a business. They had to learn how to make decisions together. But he said, you know, sometimes it's really hard, but we're working with passion because we're working for ourselves and we're working for each other. And that's so different. And he said, also, you know, we can be more competitive because we don't have to raise millions of dollars to pay a CEO. We just have to raise enough to pay ourselves and to put back into the business. So it just felt like the spirit, even though, you know, it's only about, say, 20 people who are working there, it's not a huge economic impact, but the spirit that they're bringing is contagious. So I found that very inspiring.
How are you finding your Edge of Change road trip from the point of view of doing journalism?
Well, the challenge is that I keep being invited to visit other places and learn about more innovation, to meet just extraordinary people, and it's very tempting to just go from place to place to place, but then I find that it's difficult to write it up and share it. So I end up with a lot of notes, and I have lots of interviews that I haven't had a chance to get posted on my blog yet. So I have some of them on my blog, some of them I'm going to post as soon as I can get the time to write them up. And some of them are just going to end up in my book. I'm going to be putting a book together out of this trip that's going to be looking at the power of local communities and what they're able to do, and how in so many ways, whether it's resisting the bad stuff like new fossil fuel projects, or building the kinds of communities that people want to live in, or thinking about resilience and how we're going to live if things get really tough as a result of climate change, for example. On any of those counts, the local has this enormous power to it. So that's what I'll be exploring in my book. And so some of the stories will get up onto the blog, some will get onto yesmagazine.org, and some will only be reflected in the book.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think the message is that we have more power than we might believe in our local communities. Because so much of the news media focuses on the national level and, you know, Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton. You know, we tend to sort of get mesmerized into believing that's where everything important is happening. But my conclusions from the visits I've been making is that there are actually a lot of really important things that are happening locally. And those include the new economy. They include things like working for racial justice and working for economic justice. And that in many cases, we can actually get more done at the local level that can eventually percolate to the larger society, but that the real work is local.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Sarah.
Thank you so much for having me, Diane. I really enjoyed it.
You were just listening to Sarah Van Gelder, co-founder and editor-at-large at Yes Magazine. For more information, check on the web at edgeofchange.yesmagazine.org. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on demand, and then podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on Listener Powered 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.